Mr. Hall, there were a real three.
Now, the 1st Battalion was white and the regimental staff was green.
What do you remember about the descent? Was it normal or were there any problems?
We jumped roughly about, the actual height should be 80 metres. We definitely jumped from 70 metres, which actually was a good thing. Lower you are, better you are, providing the parachute is packed properly. So it definitely opens at that time when it should open. And the parachute, what we had in them days, was the RZ-16. Then the RZ-20 was introduced, which was a far better parachute. Actually, not the parachute, it was the packing of the parachute, which was essential. And then later on also, because the parachute itself was in packed in an inner bag, which had a rope on, then that was then attached to the aircraft. And the outer pack, which was on your harness, was more or less like an envelope. And this pack was in there, and then it was fastened, and then a little pin went through, and as the body fell, you pulled the parachute out. The parachute was packed in such a way, so the 1st, the 7th, the 14th, and the 21st was turned so the air could get in, and on top it was turned again, the top. So when it opened, it was more or less like a little bit of a tip, then a round ball, and then it opened properly.
And when you landed at Malmö,
yeah.
Did you land easily, or was there
ever
any
so
damage
easy.
Done?
No, very, very few damage done, except the 1st Battalion that went in with them gliders. There were 9 men in a glider, and them others, they were jumping in also with parachutes on the way. They came down in the olive groves, and they were decimated. Terrible.
As you descended,
yes.
Were you aware of anybody shooting at you?
Yes, they were shooting at us. No harm was done because we were too far away.
What kind of fire was it?
A machine gun fire.
What kind of area did you personally land in?
It must have been roughly about a mile and a half away from the aerodrome Malmö.
Was it in fields or olive groves?
No, that was a certain field which was surrounded by a hedge and four, and that is where we should have landed, and four olive trees in it, and we landed that bit further, and it was more or less fields and olive groves as well.
What was growing in the field that you landed in?
I can't remember. I don't think it's May, you know, it is, could have been barley.
What did you do on landing? What was the first thing that
well,
you did?
Well, we grouped together and then we attacked. And we, the main aim was to get the aerodrome Malmö for other troops to land. The heights 107, which more or less was predominantly, from there you could direct everything, you know, was in British hands. And we had to get this. And during the night, the upper ring was then Germans, then was a ring round with the British, and then was a ring round again with Germans. And during the night, General Freiberg, he took them out, and I think that was a wrong move. He shouldn't have taken them out. I think he should have made us fight more for that Heights 109, which then gave us the aerodrome in the end. It didn't give it straight off, it gave us it in the end.
But once you landed and you formed a group,
yeah.
Who was commanding your group?
The commander of our troop, of our group, was Lieutenant Brown, which was a very, very eminent officer in them days, you know.
So you found all the people that you should have
lost? Yes. And then, mind you, the most then we lost was in the fight in itself, going towards Hania, or Kania, what it is. it's Hania called now, I think in the map you will see HA. We call it Kanya in the German maps.
But how big a group did Lieutenant Brown have?
That will have been also again 75 men. It's probably like a very strong platoon.
So then he told you to advance on this hike.
Yes, yes.
How did you advance?
Well, you had to get on so far as possible, then Sonsa Mene got wounded. Then you had to find out, because the New Zealanders, they were definitely very, very good sharpshooters. No getting away from that, they could shoot, believe you me. And eventually then you got nearer. Those which got wounded, you took out. You tried to get away from there. And then you went back into the position. And then next day when we then had the heights, my commanding officer, then that was Major Stenzler, Major Stenzler, he says, I want you to go and find our 7th company. And so I said to him, I said, sir, can I take Bendorf? Because I did not speak one word of English in them days. None. And Bendorf, having worked as an electrical engineer for a few months here in this country, and also having gone to a grammar school in Germany and having been taught English, and my wife will verify this, he speaks a fantastic English, like an Englishman, proper Oxford English, even today. And I took him, and we came through a disused British battle line, which wasn't shown on any aerial photographs. And I went down a hole and I stepped on something soft. It was a British soldier. I told him, come on. We walked on for about half an hour to find our 7th company. And Bendorf and the English soldier called Ben, they were talking. And I said, what is he saying? And so he told me, they moved out during the night and they forgot to call him. So they also forgot his pal, Dick. Now, Ben came from, I believe, from Liverpool, and Dick from London. And we went, so I told Bendorf to tell him to go back and fetch him, which he did. Now, they hadn't been, they left Britain 37 to the Far East. They haven't seen Britain for 4 years. And they stayed with us, coming back right to Germany, to Goslar. Unfortunately, then they were handed over into a prisoner of war camp. And the last time I did see him, Bendorf did not see him, I did see him, was 1942, must have been in June. And the place is called in the North Heide, is called not Bergen-Belsen, not Farlingbostel, not far away from Farlingbostel, Munsterlage. And we had a forced march, and we couldn't stop. They were working on a road on repair work, and all what we could do is just hello, hello, you know, armed our, and that was all. And that is the last time I did see him. Bendorf, I told, talking to Bendorf this year in June, and he said, it's a great pity I did not know the addresses in Britain. He says, I would have had a fantastic time. Because he was then eventually a prisoner of war in Kent, Bendorf.
Now, you were telling me earlier about how you captured British stores in,
yes,
Crete. Can you repeat what,
yes,
you were telling me about that?
When we came then into Kania, there was a huge, on the harbour, a huge British store, food galore, clothes galore, and Bendorf, being very inventive, he did blast a big hole in the back so we could creep through, because on the front gate there were British military police. We had to make then a cinema out of three cinemas. And so we needed workers, and we got them from the British prisoner of war camp. And every morning we fetched 25. We worked from 7 till 11 with a break. Then Bender took at least 4, maybe sometimes 5, through that hole. They got dressed and brought so much clothes back for the others, and naturally plenty of food. Never have I seen so much food in all my life. And actually, the British troop in them days of Crete, they were kept very, very short. I believe that is everywhere the same. I had the same experience 44 here in France. So this is the story.
But you were also telling me about one of them who had a
A British soldier, I said, Bender, what is wrong? And so Bender, he says, well, he wants to stay, he has a girlfriend. So I told him, but being in command, I said, 25 came out, 25 go back. And so they grabbed a Cretan civilian, marched him through the gate, 25, the number was up. Next morning he came out, and the British soldier returned to us. In them days, they couldn't go nowhere. It's not like, you know, mostly it gets then organized, an escape route gets organized roughly about 6 weeks after the fighting, before you haven't got. There's no coordination with nothing. It has to be coordinated with everything, and then naturally the escape route started, so far as I got to know later on. I wasn't there then no more.
You were also telling me earlier about the different reputations which the different national groups of the enemy have.
Yes, had,
yes. Like New
yes,
Zealanders, British yes, Canadians,
yes,
and
yes.
So on. Can you repeat to me
yes,
what you were telling me?
The British fighting forces over there, they were very, very fair. The New Zealanders were very, very sharp. Also the Australians. The British were very, very fighters.
And the Canadians?
Canadians weren't there.
But later on,
we got to know Canadians here in Italy. The French Canadians were sharp. The Canadians were good. The French Canadians were very sharp fighters. Maybe had something to do with originating from France. You know, with their homeland being still under German rule, most like. Well, their home of descent.
And what reputation did the Maoris have?
All what I heard was they were also very, very sharp fighters, and apparently they also used the knife exactly like the modern soldiers which came from the... You have them here, the little ones. Gurkhas, yes. Almost identical to them, yes. Or I did not see any Maoris. They were in the eastern part. If there were any, they were in the eastern part. I didn't see any at that particular time.
Did you have any first-hand experience of unfair tactics?
Yes. You will find that anywhere and everywhere. We were definitely also shot at, even trying to help wounded British soldiers under the flag of Red Cross, and we were fired at. Then you always will have that one who will do this on all sides, not just on one side, on all sides. Unfortunately, that is the failing of the human race.
Who was it who was firing at the Red Cross?
That definitely were troops on the opposite side of the way now. New Zealanders or Australians or British, I do not know.
Whereabouts was it?
That was still on the halfway mark between the aerodrome of Malayim and Hania.
You said earlier that there was a rumour that the Maoris felt the boots see how they'd been tied.
Yes, apparently that is what it has been said. Now, how true it is, I don't know. If one had the boot laces crossed and they felt it, then apparently they cut the throat. Now, how true that is, I don't know. I couldn't verify this. I haven't seen it.
Because German soldiers were supposed to cross their shoelaces.
Yes, yes, that is true. Yes, yes, yes. Well, here you have them crossed underneath. There, you know, they had them crossed outside.
How did your own comrades and the parachutists behave in Crete?
Our unit, they were a happy lot. I mean, the best example is if one could find Dick and Ben, if they're still alive, I do hope, they would verify that. We did treat them as human beings, as they would have treated us in any case.
Did you have any kind of relationship with Cretan civilians whilst you were there?
Yes. One became friendly because there were quite a number that were, they had no home and they were then living in dugouts and so on. They needed food, so we gave them food. We had a donkey, and so the donkey didn't feel too much chafing on his back and so on. We put British army towels on the terry towel in, and we had that in a heap there, and so they came and washed it and they were perfectly white, so it was more or less help each other. Now what happened later on, I do not know, when we left, because then it came under Italian rule, and what happened then I don't know. The only thing I do know, they put a huge war memorial up for, and I only have seen it in pictures, I haven't seen it directly, and it is the flying eagle with a swastika down on bottom, that is the emblem of the German paratroopers. And then also von der Heide, he put a war memorial up on one side for Führer, Volk und Vaterland, so and so, and on the opposite side it was for King and Country, where British soldiers got buried.
You also told me earlier that there was a Cretan who acted as interpreter.
This particular Cretan, he must have been about, maybe 45, and he had been in captivity in Germany. Now, why, I don't know, in the Great War 1418, apparently he went there to school. He spoke perfect German, and I said, how do you come here? And he was then our interpreter. On occasions, I went there to have this and that translated, and in particular, well, we needed timber and so on, and that had to be paid for. Now, if it got paid, I do not know. That was the rule when we were there. It had to be paid for. So what happened then, I don't know.
What happened to you after Crete?
We came back to Goslar. We had then this triumphant march in Goslar, because then the Goslar population received us then with honors. At the beginning they didn't, because the so-called Jäger, which had been there, they weren't there no more. And so they took us in. We were on the aerodrome, there in Goslar, the Fliegerhorst. And then we went on holiday, on leave, came back, regrouped down in Grafenwehr, and we went to Wildflecken, regrouped, and then we went up to Russia, where the Russian and the River Neva, which is between the Lake of Ladoga, Schlüsselburg, and Leningrad, formed a huge bridgehead of 20,000 Russian soldiers. We went in with 1,050 firepower, and it took us 5 days to take that back, because it is said the River Neva will freeze up in 9 cold nights, and then it's possible to take tanks over, which is true. They naturally got then strengthened, and maybe one you have seen the three, no, no, one, what is it, 900 days in circle of Leningrad, where even railway lines were laid across the Lake of Ladoga to take war material and foodstuff into Leningrad. So strong is that ice.
And so you were acting as infantry, not paratroop.
We were then as a paratrooper. That is only a form to get there. Now you can also be taken there as infantry, and that is you only then a specialized infantry, because it's a different training one does have to go in. It's different to get altogether to the infantry itself.
And who was in charge of your unit at that time?
At that time it was Major Stenzler, who got very badly wounded, and he died 4 weeks later. He died in Königsberg in a military hospital.
Did you see him get wounded?
Yes, yes.
How did this happen?
It's with rifle fire. He was leading. The paratroopers, the officers never lead from the back. They're always on the front line with the soldiers. That is the training one has. Maybe that is to spawn everybody on. You know, we have to achieve this and that and so on, which we did do with a very great big loss, over 500 lost.
When you got to the front on the River Neva, was there a continuous line of trenches or anything like
well,
that?
Well, we had to build them. It had to be built. Well, you built in bunkers, and because it already got then cold, and you only could go so far down, because otherwise then you were on ground water. So you only dug out so much and built bunkers, and timber was plenty there. In Schlüsselburg I went in and we fetched timber out, because from that particular place, what we had taken and where we lost so many, then Major von der Heide with the 3rd Battalion, he took over. He then became the highest reserve general in the Bundeswehr. Maybe you have heard that name. Have you heard that name mentioned?
Yes.
Von der Heide. If he's still alive, I don't know. And we were then moved to Schlüsselburg. It's from Schlüsselburg around the River Neva, and there was then the 5th, the 6th, the 7th, and the 5th, the 6th, the 7th, and the 8th Company. We were moved around there. And I, with my platoon, I did lay in reserve. So if anything happened, we had to go in. And because being in reserve, with Benderov, we went every day into Schlüsselburg, fetched timber, cut, because nails were not there, so you had to make frames where you don't need nails to nail it up. So you made frames. And at 5 o'clock I went to the front line, which was only about, 2 miles and a half, measured out what they had dug out, you know, during the day and blasted. And then, not always at the same time, either at 12 or sometimes already at 8, we took it forward on sledges, ourselves camouflaged in white clothes so we weren't seen, because in Schlüsselburg there was a factory which was shut down, and we found underneath, pulling it out, you know, damask and fantastic material, which we dried on when we made ourselves our snow suits, you know. Well, so long to camouflage yourself in the background of the snow.
How did the Russians fight on the River Neva?
They were very, very good fighters. Very, very good fighters. And one should realize, I think that is where Hitler made the biggest mistake. He thought the Russians, they were still the fighters as they were 1418. This isn't so. They might not have been all communists. They might not have been all agreeing with Stalin. They were fighting for their homeland. And when people realize the whole war production of the Russian armored forces were moved 2,000 miles to the east, and 1942 in July, they outstripped the German war production by 3-1. That means to say the German made one tank, they made three. And the T-34 was the best tank I ever have seen.
Why was it so good?
Quick. The gun was the 7.62mm gun, which actually was made by Krupp in the 30s, found too big for the German forces, sold over, that is all what I heard, sold over Romania to Russia, and the Russians, they paid with over Romania with timber to the Germans. And then when they had that pact in. And I always remember there was still a secret pact between Germany and Russia, because after the Great War 1418, they were not allowed to join the League of Nations. So they had a pact. Germany only could have 100,000 men armed, and they had to serve 12 years. So they came around, they served 10 and 2 years schooling, so they could replace them with two more. And they had apparently 3,000 armed forces on the blacklist, which were trained in Russia. Now, how true that is, I do not know. All that is what I have heard and read.
But you said they fought well on the Neva.
Very, very well.
Can you give some detailed examples?
If they attacked you, they wouldn't just simply have put the arms up. You had to shoot, or you had to shoot them. They were definitely fighting for their country.
So they were fighting to the death?
Oh, yes, they were. They were fantastic troops. Now, I got wounded on the 12th of November.
How did that happen?
Again, the Russians broke through further down on the river, roughly about, 10 kilometers away from Schlüsselburg on the River Neva. And we went there to drive him back. And all what I remember is, you know, when you attack, you jump up and you all go forward. It's like the birds when they come, they fly. So the hawk, what wants to take a bird, he doesn't know which one. It's exactly there. When you attack, you jump in a big force and forward. And he must have, that sharpshooter must have noticed, aha, he is the one in gang, so I have him.
He is the one what?
Well, he is the one in charge of this particular group, so. And they shot, and I had my rifle here, it went in here in that finger, exploded, and naturally it took so much off.
Hit you on the left hand?
Left, yes.
Where you were carrying your rifle?
Yeah, and that was a Russian rifle. Again, a Russian sharpshooter rifle.